Thank you, Lewis. We'll have a chance to speak with Lewis more during the Q&A period. I'd like to start with our panelists. Our first panelist is Alan Bach.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Lewis. And thank all of you. My goodness, what a wonderful turnout. I bring you greetings from Southern California, where I grew up and where I still manage to live. And I used to hate San Francisco just before I ever came in contact with it. It's one of the, you know, it's one of those north-south kind of things. But having actually come and visited a number of times over the years, this is such a wonderful place. And again, we're seeing the specialness of San Francisco, I think, tonight. A good bit of the discussion of what role, if any, U.S. foreign policy played in the terrorist attacks last September 11th has been bullied out of the marketplace by the contention that any criticism of foreign policy, especially in the wake of 9/11, amounts to being an apologist for terrorism or a knee-jerk blame America first type. With the country under attack, now is no time to be rehearsing yet again the mistakes of the past or undermining our resolve by carping at the commander-in-chief. Don't you know there's a war on? The admonition not to carp is not consistently applied, however. I've heard a number of commentators been given media time to lament the weakness and irresolution of the Clinton years, when the commander-in-chief, distracted by Monica, impeachment, and everything else, fired missiles randomly and insufficiently, passed up several chances to nab Osama bin Laden on a silver platter. If only our foreign policy had been more resolute, then maybe September 11th might never have happened. So apparently it is fair game to criticize U.S. foreign policy and harp on the past. Fine. But let's have criticism and backbiting from as many angles as possible. And I think we've had not enough from enough different angles, so let's get that game going. In suggesting, as I will, that U.S. foreign policy and its intrusive and interventionist character was a contributing factor to the terror attacks is not an apology for terrorism. Even if al-Qaeda's cause were as just and pure as, say, Woodrow Wilson's, nothing could justify that kind of deliberate attack on innocents who had nothing to do with creating your real or imagined grievances. But if we really want to reduce our vulnerability to terrorism, surely it can't be out of bounds to try to understand the rage, madness, twisted ideas, or whatever it is that motivates these terrorists. If we discover, as we will, that U.S. foreign policy contributed to that rage, we might decide not to change it. Life's full of trade-offs. You might just decide that, you know, an attack on the World Trade Center every so often is a reasonable price to pay for being acknowledged as the sole superpower and the bringer of truth and enlightenment to the dark places of the earth where democracy has not yet triumphed. But at least we should discuss those risks and benefits openly and acknowledge that there are both risks and benefits to our policies. I don't know whether 9/11 can be classified strictly as blowback, the apparently CIA-originated term that Chalmers Johnson, the professor emeritus at University of California, used to title his latest book. And incidentally, I went down and had lunch with him at his place down north of San Diego. What a delightful man. But, you know, blowback is, you know, sort of the unexpected, uninvited negative aspects of an operation. And every operation has some. Even the best planned and most successful have negative aspects to them, and sometimes they blow up right in your face. But there is at least evidence that it motivated Osama bin Laden. In statements prior to 9/11, he specifically listed the presence of U.S. troops and bases in the land containing Mecca and other holy Islamic places as one of his grievances. Now, whether it was a real motivator or a pretext, I don't think you could probably know without extensive psychological analysis. But it's got to be significant that he mentioned it. so it ought to be worthy of some kind of discussion. We know and have known that U.S. policy toward Israel, which I'm not as critical of as some people, I think it's sort of support with kvetching, but we know that it angers a lot of Muslims. The U.S. has troops in more than 130 countries and interests everywhere. It may be unfair that others resent us, and it is undoubtedly true that resentment is stirred up and manipulated by ambitious and unscrupulous opportunists. But, fair or not, those resentments are there and are not likely to disappear. They're part of the price of empire, hegemony, success, desire to share the benefits of your way of life, or whatever you want to call it, that to describe America's place in the world. Any reflective, mature person should know this. It turns out, for example, as the Cato Institute pointed out in a couple of policy studies published prior to 9/11, which were in turn based on Department of Defense studies, that the presence of heavy concentrations of American positions, troops, or activity in some part of the world is closely correlated to increased terrorist activities. Now, that may not prove causality, but it's kind of interesting. It's hardly a surprise. The presence of a foreign power, even a perfectly benevolent one, will breed local resentment. The Defense Department knew this intuitively. They studied it to try to get a handle on it. If we acknowledge that a foreign policy of intervention, preemption, or preventive war and nation building carries risks as well as benefits, we'll be in a better position to develop intelligent policies based on realistic information rather than theories and dreams. A few years ago, political science professor James Kurtz of Swarthmore wrote a piece, I think it was in The National Interest, characterizing empires using the categories of the age and qualities of the people they venerated. And thus, for example, he noted that the Roman Empire tended to venerate the young, bold warrior, maybe in his late 20s or early 30s, whereas the Austro-Hungarian Empire venerated the guy with the white beard who had lived a number of years and accumulated experience and wisdom. You see all these portraits of these Austro-Hungarians with the silver hair and the great long beards. And he said that he then characterized America as the adolescent empire. Not just because we haven't been at this empire business very long, but because we're a culture obsessed with youth and beauty. We make Britney Spears and NSYNC enormously wealthy. And we want aging rock stars to sound just like they did back in the day. Unfortunately, our attention span in foreign affairs is about as long as that of somebody who's already bored with Britney and searching aimlessly for the next big thing. Now, that might not be a terrible thing to say about Americans. We are kind of self-obsessed, and we're remarkably innocent. But on the whole, we kind of think of ourselves as benevolent and well-intentioned. And outside of a narrow coterie of foreign policy professionals and defense intellectuals, whatever that term might describe, we don't have the slightest interest in running an empire or telling the rest of the world what to do. But to have their, you know, we want to refinance our house or get it decorated or get the next big job. Or follow our own enthusiasms rather than worrying about what some resentful loser on the other side of the world wants to do to you and yours because of what our leaders have been doing in our name. Well, I think it may be time for us to take enough interest in foreign affairs to derail that small band of would-be world fixers who are running things now and seem intent on getting us into more wars. Thank you.
Our next speaker, our next panelist, is Jonathan Marshall.
Thank you very much. As I was considering what to say about the war on terrorism, the title of tonight's discussion, I realized the whole topic is actually passé. It has been since Bush gave his State of the Union address early this year and announced that the real issue was the axis of evil. And of course, the war on terrorism is now being relegated to the footnotes, except for our occasional anniversary memorials. The real issue, of course, today is Iraq and soon to be Iran, North Korea, and whatever other country gets on the list of the axis of evil. A couple of Bush's admirers, Robert Kagan and William Kristol, writing in the Weekly Standard, a leading conservative newspaper, lauded the administration for its expansive new American foreign policy, a paradigm shift equal to the inauguration of anti-communist containment. They said Bush has taken the war on terrorism beyond a police action and transformed it into a campaign to uproot dangerous tyrannies and encourage democracy, making the world much safer for free peoples. So you can imagine where all of that will lead to. The chosen instrument of this new expansive policy that they are lauding, which goes far beyond the war on terrorism, is what has been so benignly called regime change, a nicely antiseptic term that we will soon be practicing on Iraq. And I wanted to spend just a few minutes looking at the historical record, which unfortunately most of the media have been wont to do, because regime change is not a new aspect of American foreign policy. It's one that's been going on. Lewis mentioned the intervention in the Philippines. You can go back even longer than that. But specifically looking at the Middle East, which is the focus of attention now, I thought it would be instructive to look at a few examples of regime change. Our current target, Iraq, has tasted this medicine before, twice in fact, with very interesting results. The first time was in 1963, when the CIA station in Baghdad helped orchestrate a coup against the reigning general and put in a new group, including members of the Ba'ath Party, who had been biding their time in Egypt. And they succeeded with CIA help in overthrowing the government. The CIA then handed over a list of people who were later killed by the new regime. And one of the people that was brought to power, who was a young member of the Ba'ath Party, was Saddam Hussein, brought to you by the CIA. Several years passed of domestic turmoil, and there was a second coup in 1968, also brought about with CIA help. This time, the Ba'ath Party was brought completely to power, and the deputy in charge of the new regime was Saddam Hussein. In 1979, he took full charge as dictator of the country. And as you know, within basically 2 years, he was the new darling of the Reagan-Bush I administration, having invaded Iran in 1980, taking on America's new enemy, the country that had, of course, seized the American embassy and was now spawning an Islamic revolution throughout the Middle East. And as you probably know, the Reagan-Bush administration gave the Iraqi regime about $1.5 billion in credits to buy high-tech equipment, including weapons, gave them top-secret satellite imaging to help them wage their war against Iran, and even gave export licenses for the shipment of nearly 24 shipments of anthrax, along with botulin toxin and other nice products that no doubt he put to good use. The reason that the Washington in that time was in bed with Saddam Hussein was we were trying to rectify the damage that had been done in Iran, which, as I mentioned, as you all know, was the new American enemy. The damage done there was also a product of regime change. In 1953, when the democratically elected government of Mossadegh had a couple of years earlier nationalized the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and the British came to the United States saying this was unacceptable, and jointly British intelligence and the CIA waged Operation Ajax, which was then long considered a great success story for the CIA, overthrew Mossadegh and put the Shah back on the throne. The Shah, as you know, proceeded to kill thousands of people, throw tens of thousands into jail, spend and squander most of the country's oil money on buying U.S. and European arms, until finally an underground led by a group of radical clerics, among them the Ayatollah Khomeini, managed to win enough popular support to overthrow the Shah in 1979, delivering this vast new problem onto America's doorstep. So that was regime change number two, or number three if you count both Iraqi regime changes earlier. The Iranian Revolution spawned all of the modern examples of militant political Islam that we're seeing around much of the world, especially in the Middle East and South Asia. One of the places that was infected by the bug was Afghanistan. In 1979, Afghanistan was ruled by a secular regime, which was showing increasing pro-Soviet tendencies. And among other policies that the regime was conducting were policies of land reform, opium suppression, and women's rights, along with their pro-Soviet tilt in foreign policy. The Carter administration approved, that's in the summer of 1979, a program of secret assistance to the newly formed Mujahideen, basically a group of ultra-conservative rural groups, some of them warlords and others, who resented the central government's modernizing tendencies. And as a State Department memo that summer, again 1979, said, the United States' larger interest would be served by the demise of the regime, despite whatever setbacks this might mean for future social and economic reforms in Afghanistan. The overthrow of the government would show the rest of the world, particularly the Third World, that the Soviets' view of the socialist course of history being inevitable is not accurate. So as former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski has admitted, CIA assistance started long before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and indeed was designed in part to provoke such an invasion. Brzezinski proudly told French interviewers 3 or 4 years ago that he was trying to provoke such an invasion so that the Soviets would have their own Vietnam. And to this day, he's proud of that. He thinks that was a great victory. Well, as we all know, in trying to create a Soviet Vietnam, the United States armed, trained, and supplied the new Mujahideen, who were, of course, Islamic fundamentalists, many of them subscribing to the most militant sects of Islam promoted by extreme Saudi clerics. With Saudi support and support from Pakistani military intelligence, the CIA supported a program of bringing in Muslim revolutionaries from all over the world to help with this revolt against the government of Afghanistan to create regime change. Ultimately, as many as 100,000 Muslims from around the world were brought into contact with this effort. One of these, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who in fact headed some of the key houses where these Muslims were brought. Well, today, of course, we're paying the price. In Afghanistan, we're still bogged down with no end in sight, trying to repair the country that we helped tear apart. The two other countries I've mentioned where we did regime change are now two of the three members of the Axis of Evil. And Iraq is preparing to take its third dose of regime change medicine. I think it's time we wake up and recognize not only the tremendous human cost in the region itself of policies that we've been conducting for years of regime change, but the tremendous cost to the United States itself of such incredibly short-sighted and counterproductive policy. Thank you.